listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. It is my great honor to introduce one of today's preeminent conductors, James Conlin. He has cultivated a vast symphonic, operatic, and choral repertoire and developed enduring relationships with many of the world's most prestigious symphony orchestras and opera houses. Since his New York Philharmonic debut in 1974, Mr. Conlin has appeared as guest conductor with virtually every major North American and European orchestra and has been a frequent guest conductor at the Metropolitan Opera for over 30 years. He is music director of the Los Angeles Opera, music director of the Ravinia Festival, the summer home of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, and music director of the Cincinnati May Festival, where he celebrated his 30th anniversary in May 2009. He served as principal conductor of the Paris National Opera, general music director of the City of Cologne, and music director of the Rotterdam Philharmonic. During the 2009-10 season at LA Opera, Mr. Conlin continues his first ring cycle in the United States, which began during the 2008-2009 season with the final two operas in the cycle, Wagner's Siegfried and Gotterdammerung. I'm not even going back. He will also conduct Donizetti's Le Zizzor d'Amore and continue his Recovered Voices series, a multi-year project during which he brings the music of composers suppressed by the Nazi regime to the LA Opera stage with the U.S. premiere of The Stigmatized. During the 2009 season, he returns to the Metropolitan Opera to conduct Berlioz's La Damnation de Faust and to La Scala to conduct Verdi's Rigoletto. He has orchestral engagements with the Los Angeles Phil, the Orchestra Sinfonietta Nazionale della RAI, Orchestra del Teatro Comunale Bologna, orchestras in Spain and in Russia, and a European tour with the Chamber Orchestra of Europe. In an effort to raise public consciousness to the significance of works of composers whose lives and compositions were suppressed by the Nazi regime, he's devoted himself to extensive programming of this music in North America and Europe. At both the Ravinia Festival and LA Opera, he continues to program works of these composers, including Alexander von Zemlinsky, Victor Ullmann, Pavel Haas, Kurt Weill, Eric Wolfgang Korngold, Karl Amadeus Hartmann, Erwin Schulhoff, and Ernest Krennic. Mr. Conlin has recorded extensively for many record labels, including EMI, Sony Classical, and Telarc, for which he has received numerous citations. He's been featured on DVDs for Decca, and has appeared on many television series for PBS. He won two Grammy Awards, Best Classical Recording and Best Opera Album, for conducting LA Opera's production of Kurt Weill's Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni, which was released on the Euro Arts label. He is the recipient of many awards, as you can imagine. I'm just going to mention a few. He received the Crystal Globe Award from the Anti-Defamation League for his efforts in championing the work of composers silenced by the Third Reich. He is the recipient of three honorary doctorates, and he received also from the New York Public Library a Library Lions Award in 2005. In 2002, James Conlin received France's highest distinction from the President of the French Republic, Jacques Chirac, the Légion d'honneur. And tonight, his lecture is titled Richard Wagner's Ring, Eros, Mythos, and Ethos. Please welcome Maestro James Conlin. Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you to all for coming tonight. Louise, thank you very much for a lovely introduction. And before I start up, I would also like to thank the Los Angeles Public Library and the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. And this is a very special moment for me because a lot of Los Angeles residents and citizens, there are either ex-New Yorkers or the children of ex-New Yorkers. I am rapidly becoming an ex-New Yorker because I love Los Angeles so much. You like that? No. And I have to honestly say that I grew up in the New York public libraries. ex-New Yorker? Yeah, okay. So it's a special thrill to be for the first time in a Los Angeles public library. When I was born in that little island called Manhattan, I grew up in Queens. And, you know, at a certain point, I was a young, aside from my student years, as a young musician, I come from a non-musical family and fell in love with classical music at the age of 11. And by the time I was 13, I knew what I wanted to do. And I announced that to my parents, who just sort of stared at me and said, "What?" You know, I mean, they were very supportive and then very helpful, of course, and very loving. But nobody quite knew what to do with me. And we did not come from a family of means, so I couldn't get a golden education right away. I would say that if it weren't for the New York City Public Library and the opportunities in New York City public schools and the fact that there was Carnegie Hall and the Metropolitan Opera there, I know that I would not be where I am today, because that was my education up until the time I finally at the ripe age of 18 went to Juilliard. But I do owe all that to the public libraries, because I didn't have a penny, and you didn't need a penny to get out all the books you needed or to spend all the hours just pouring through things. And in those days, you could get recordings. And so that this is a big thrill to come here today. And I know I have a big task, because somehow, you know, in the course of an hour or so, I'm supposed to reveal the entire Ring of Richard Wagner to you. Now, as you know, it's 15 hours of music, which took over 20 years to compose. And so I'm going to give you just a few thoughts, a few ideas, an overall view. I know if I'm addressing any Wagnerites out there, you probably know a great deal. You may know more than I do, but you may know a lot about what I'm going to talk about, so I hope it's not repetitious to you. But I very much hope that there are those of you out there who may never have seen a Wagner opera, and it's my goal today to make this interesting, and so that you will come, because Wagner is, of course, one of the great, great transcendent geniuses of Western civilization. I'm not even going to limit that to say he was a great composer, or he was a great opera composer, or he was a great 19th century composer. Very few people in the history of Western art have created on the scale that he created, and who have impacted the world the way Richard Wagner has. And that includes, although primarily classical music, it includes theater, poetry, to a lesser degree, philosophy. But certainly nobody could escape from Wagner. He was also, just as he was, a great, great, enormous, massive composer, and he only composed massive works. String trios that last 10 minutes. Everything is on a massive scale. He was a massive personality, outsized personality. And so he created also outsized, massive controversy. He did that himself. He was accompanied by controversy all his life. He provoked controversy all his life. And he continues to provoke controversy to this day. And most of that controversy is not about tastes. I mean, some people like his music, some people don't. Some people love this, going into these mythical worlds and sitting there fascinated and moved, as I am every time I hear or see a Wagner opera or conduct a Wagner opera. And then there are those who just don't like it. Well, de gustibus nonis disputandum est. There's no arguing tastes. But the controversies that follow him today are not so much about what he did to art or how he revolutionized classical music. They have to do with the fact that he was probably amongst all the composers, many of whom had irascible personalities, and you know, you may not would have liked them as your neighbor. I mean, certainly Beethoven's neighbors couldn't stand him. He was a very unattractive human being in many respects, and some of those respects he wrote copiously. You know, he probably wrote more about himself than anybody. There's 10 volumes about his. A lot of it is philosophy and philosophy of music, philosophy of music, drama, and theory. But also some of it was political. And of course, he was also anti-Semitic, and he wrote a very horrifying article to that. So he is generally viewed as a most flawed human being. But the mystery of genius is, how is it possible that flawed human beings produce great works and great artworks? And you know, I'm certainly not a genius. I work with a lot of talented people in the theater, and I can tell you we are all flawed human beings. In fact, I can tell you every day about how those flaws show up. One of the things about being a conductor is you're not like a pianist who practices hours and hours and hours all by yourself and communes directly with nature and music. I commune with human beings. I don't make a sound, but I commune with 80 musicians in an orchestra and 60 musicians in a chorus and about 200 people in a theater. And I can tell you that the relationship between humanity and what they produce on the stage it's a quaint idea to think that only we're all wonderful people who just do beautiful things. We may be wonderful people, but we're just like everybody else. We're full of our faults. So those are some of the big pictures. This is a special moment in Los Angeles, and why is that? It's because The Ring has never been produced in this city. This wonderful city, which I'm now beginning to call my own, is for some reason way behind. I don't know of any other city of this size in the Western world that's never had a ring. And so this is a great, great, great moment. Maybe it's because Los Angeles Opera is still a baby company. We will be 25 years old next year. But it's a very exciting moment. It's a very exciting moment that the Ring Festival, which will take place in June, has 115 collaborators, amongst them the Los Angeles Public Library, to see. Well, it's not to introduce you so much to the music. It is to appreciate the how the Ring is almost the center of the wheel, and with all the spokes going out from that center point of the wheel, the Ring is a seminal work, as I mentioned, for what comes after it. But also, it is a result of so much culture. Old Nordic myths, German literature, Greek literature, and all of those things. All the things that went into making Wagner's music and his art what it is. And that's what's being looked at between now and the end of June. So there are plenty of other opportunities to see how it relates to art, how it relates to literature, how it relates to religion, just about everything. So to those of you that are Wagner fans out there, I don't need to advertise or to introduce any of this to you. But you do know, many of you, that the Ring is so extraordinary that there are what we call ring freaks. Ring freaks travel all over the world to see every ring. There was a gentleman here a short time ago who I think was on his 84th ring. We're getting a lot of them here in June. So I guess you can ask the question, you know, if it's worth hearing 84 times and traveling around the world, it must have something. And yet the common view for those who've never heard it is, oh, Lord, I hear it's very long. You know, and yes, it is. It is long. But I do know that once it infects you or affects you, your concept of the passage of time is radically altered. And I'm actually disappointed when it's over at the end. Of course, I get to conduct it, which is sort of fun. I find that you go into a zone, and this zone takes you out of the present and into the eternal. It takes you out of your time and place and moves you into a sphere. And that is all from the power of music. Yes, you know, it is what Wagner called a Gesamtkunstwerk. That's a complete artistic work. It is It is theater, it is drama, it is prose, it is orchestra music, it is singing, it is all those things together. But in the end, the essence of that magic, which is Wagner, is musical. It's about the notes, it's about this extraordinary harmonies, it's about the exciting music, it is about the exaltation of this music, it is about the deep, expressive moments of human and godly suffering and yearning and desire. It's about all of that. And so if you are inhibited about the length, or you don't know the subject, ignore that. I'll take one more page from my own life. I used to go to the Metropolitan Opera as a young student. I stood very often in the back for 75 cents in those days. $1.25 if you were downstairs in the old Metropolitan Opera. I remember hearing my first Wagner operas in the mid-60s, 64, 65, 66, 1966. I hadn't a clue what was going on. I didn't understand any German. I barely knew the story outline. There were no surtitles in those days. And I stood there, or sat there, mesmerized, and went home, back on the subways, just in another world, not understanding everything. And the reason I share that with you is that a lot of people have the feeling, I have to know about this. Somehow I have to be an educated person. I have to be cultured. Any of those things, you don't have to be. Anybody can be moved by a Wagner opera. In fact, I took my mother, who was not a musician, and although I could say she had a somewhat musical nature, she had absolutely no training, knew nothing. Despite the fact she had a German father, spoke no German, went to the opera. I remember taking her to Parsifal, and I said, Mom, I just have to tell you one thing. It's very long, and a lot of it is very slow. Now she said, no, I don't mind. I'm going to go. So we went together. I remember seeing my mother's face. I looked around at the end of Act One of Parsifal, just a little worried, and she sat there. She said, I have never heard anything more beautiful than this in my life. Amazing. And my mother was already at that time, I would say, probably 50 years old, 50, 55 years old. So it is never too late for to touch you. So I just want to share those with you so that if you're afraid, don't be afraid. There's nothing to know. And by the way, we have surtitles. And if you go to the first opera of The Ring, Wagner loves to narrate. He loves to tell stories. In fact, his I shouldn't call them operas, they're music dramas, are based on the principle of narrative. They keep telling the story. And if you miss the first opera, don't worry, because he retells all the background in the second one, and in the third one, and in the fourth one. So it doesn't matter where you come in on the story. This is something to do with length, of course, if you have to retell that story. And it reflects the way that Wagner actually wrote the story. He wrote the story backwards. He intended to write the story of the death of a great hero, and that great hero's name was Siegfried, and he was going to call it Siegfried's Tod, which is Siegfried's death. And when he finished it all, he realized that he really ought to explain how Siegfried's origins, and how he grew up in the forest, brought up by a strange dwarf of a man, and never saw human beings, neither man nor woman, played with bears and things like that. So he wrote Siegfried. And then, did Siegfried have parents? Well, yes, he did. There were Sieglinde and Siegmund. And so back there, well, then there's also Brunhilde, who's been sleeping up on a rock. Well, how did she get up on that rock for 20 years? So he kept backing up until he got to the beginning of the story. And the beginning of the story is a very fundamental mythical story. And that is called Das Rheingold, which is the gold that comes out of the Rhine River. And how does the story begin? In the Rhine River, literally in the Rhine River. And there is gold, and that gold is tended and cared for and adored by three Rhine maidens who are symbolic also of nature. And the world is in basically in harmony until somebody does something. Then comes a dwarf. And he's not really wicked, but he does something wicked. And that gets the whole thing started. He wants to make love to the Rhine maidens. Of course, they swim around. They don't have clothes. And he is attracted to them, of course. There have been many, sirens. And, all the myths have sirens, these lovely ladies who swim around. And or
the Hexelei there in German literature. There are these wicked witches that in the forest who look beautiful, and then of course they kill you. He wants to make love to the Rhine maidens, and one by one they tease him and, of course, reject him. And then he sees the gold, and they explain only he who renounces love can have the gold. And he's now very practical. He figures, well, I'm not going to get any love anyway. I might as well take the gold and the gold, and if you forge a ring out of this gold, you will be the master of the world. Well, he decides, no love, I'm going to be the master. Well, this is, in essence, a basic truth, mythological, if you like, sociological, if you like, psychological, as you like. But the lust for power, which is, of course, one of the great human frailties, is almost always opposed to the full mandate and dictates of compassionate love. So that by renouncing love, you are open to the temptation and the ambition to have power. And you can have absolute power if you absolutely renounce love. So as you know, absolute power corrupts, you know, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. This is the story of the ring. And then it's going to be, there is this entire mythological aspect, and that's about the gods and a cosmic drama. Wotan, who's like Zeus, and Fricka is his wife, and what their story is, because they act like human beings, that the loss of the gold's place in the Rhine River is the Garden of Paradise. It becomes paradise lost. It was, you know, the world was in harmony with itself. Human frailty abused that harmony and therefore set in motion all sorts of problems, basically. And those problems will work themselves out, or they won't work themselves out. There will be confrontation and struggle over all of that until such time as the ring is returned to the Rhine. And it will be, at the end of those 15 hours, will go back and be returned to the Rhine. So it's in many respects, it's a green myth as well, because there's a great deal. You can look at these myths in many, many, many different ways. And there have been Marxist productions of the ring. There have been McKinseyan. There have been Freudian. You name it. There's been, you know, some kind of take on the ring. Well, you know, you could also do a green ring. Why can you do all of this? Is because myths are inexhaustible, and they are so broad and they are so wide in their application that you can extract any one of those elements and reduce your interpretation to that. Been viewed as the Industrial Revolution. There are many ways to look at it. However, I think that the myth is experienced in its greatest power when it is not reduced and limited to a specific of human civilization. The myth evokes everything, and so you can have any type of reaction to a myth, because it is about infinite truths. I want to quote here two quotes, maybe more, about the myth. Here's one. The incomparable truth about myth is that it is true for all time, and its content, however closely compressed, is inexhaustible through the ages. The only task of the poet is to expound it. That's one quote. Here's another quote. Mythology is an art form that points beyond history to what is timeless in human existence, helping us get beyond the chaotic flux of random events and glimpse the core of reality. Second quote. Here's a third one. The role of the artist, I now understand, is that of revealing through the world's surfaces the implicit forms of the soul, and the great agent to assist the artist was the myth. Now, the first of those, the one that said the incomparable truth about myth is that it is true for all time, was written by Richard Wagner. Okay? The second one, mythology is an art that points beyond history, is written by Karen Armstrong in A Short History of Myth. You may know she writes extensively on the world's religions.
And the last one, the role of the artist, I now understand, is that of revealing through the world surfaces the implicit forms of the soul. And that's Joseph Campbell, who, of course, is the guru comparative myths in the world. So the ring has that power, and it is applicable, in a sense, all times and all places, because the myth itself is inexhaustible. And, of course, I maintain that the music is inexhaustible. You may find it exhausting, but it is it exhausts us in a very, very good way, because after you have been to one of those operas, you feel that you have been through a cosmic experience. It will bring you up and down and bounce you from side to side. For me, it's better. I don't take drugs, I never did, but I've imagined if you took drugs, this is the best drug in the world because it's a healthy one. It is stimulating, it is profoundly moving, it is cathartic, it is uplifting. It has an addictive effect too. That's why there are ring nuts who will go to 84 rings, and that's why I was infected as a teenager, and I've still not gotten over it at my age. Now, what is Wagner actually? What are his goals, and what is he trying to do? Well, Wagner imagined that there was once upon a time there was a unified art form, and that and he posits that it was in ancient Greek civilization, that the Greeks, the art of the Greeks, theater, prose, poetry, singing, all took place in the context of a community celebrating itself and marking religious holidays and festivities. So he's saying that there is a single form, and the theater for the Greeks was a moment where they were singing, and poetry, by the way, lyric, the word lyric implies singing, so that a lyric poem was sung. You had the theater form, the amphitheater, which the Greeks perfected, also had a part of it called the orchestra. Now, our word for orchestra comes from actually a part of the theater. So he posited that the Greeks had it all, they had it all, and it was unified because the entire community understood and experienced this theatrical event together, and that it was all about their gods. In other words, it was simultaneously religion, community, and art. Then he posited that it broke up gradually, and each became a separate discipline. Poetry became poetry, singing became singing, music became music, theater became its theater. Religion was, of course, still there, and so it was to be found in the church and rituals. So his idea was that was a moment when the entire, a little bit like the gold in the Rhine, that was the moment where there was a unity. And it split up and developed. And so music and all of these things had developed now separately. And he imagined that he could recreate in the 19th century the equivalent of the Greek experience. Now, I'm not sure if you broke it down, and I'm certainly not. I would think some experts on ancient Greece might be able to knock holes in that, say, "Well, no, it wasn't this way at all." And I think of there's a line I remember hearing in I, Claudius. Somebody says, "Well, things aren't the way they used to be," and then somebody gets up and says, "Yes, things were never the way they used to be." So it may be that Wagner's wrong about this, but it doesn't matter because it was the muse for Wagner. That's what inspired him, and that he had this vision. And it may be that he needed to construct a view of a paradise lost in order to go forward and to construct and to create his new work. So along the way, he certainly recognizes that there were high points in each individual discipline, and for him, the high point in music, and it's very timely, of course, was Beethoven, because Wagner was born in 1813. In three more years, we'll be marking his 200th birthday, Wagner. So he's growing up in the height of the age of Beethoven, and so as he grows up, he looks at Beethoven, as almost everybody did at the time, the giant of his time, and leaves a shadow. He wants to make music
like Beethoven. At the same time, he feels the same way about Shakespeare. He felt that there was nothing higher than the Shakespearean drama, the marriage of poetry and drama. And so he basically wants to create a work that is worthy of Beethoven musically and worthy of Shakespeare dramatically. No small task. Fortunately for Wagner, he was gifted with a supreme ego. Some will call it megalomania, and maybe it was. He was deeply convinced that he was the great genius of his age, and he resented and suffered a great deal because he was also a manic depressive and a rather paranoid personality. He suffered a great deal in his life because he felt he was not adequately recognized. And he wasn't. He wasn't. He was not wrong about that. You know that old thing, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they aren't really against you. Wagner had many enemies, and Wagner perceived many enemies. But that's his personality. The fact is, he felt he knew something that nobody else knew, and he wanted to not just to get it down on paper. He wanted to realize it. I mean, obnoxious as that type of ego is, turns out he was right. He did see things that nobody had seen. He did hear sounds that nobody had heard, and he was able to put it together, realize it in a way that almost nobody else. And so the Ring, and I'm not just saying it's the Ring, I would say it's the entire corpus of Wagner's works, but certainly the Ring is the most is the grandest of them all, occupies a central point in the history of Western art. Drama, theater, poetry, music all together, and it marries them on a scale that is unprecedented, unparalleled, and to this day, in my opinion at least, unsurpassed. There is nothing as extensive and as important as the Ring. Now, Ed, why is it necessary to have rings in our life nowadays? Well, I mean, I think any work of art that is that great, people deserve and need to experience it firsthand. Now, you may say, well, I don't need to experience that. I'm perfectly fine the way I am. And we are, I hope, all fine the way we are. But that doesn't mean there isn't more. And that's one of the reasons I think that it's terribly important to experience the Ring live. Now, there, of course, I'm going to take the elements apart slightly. There is an almost symphonic structure to this enormous work. There are four operas, and I could make a parallel to a symphony. Most symphonies of the era had four movements. The first movement is an expository movement. It exposes all the themes and develops them in a certain way, which is called sonata form. For any of you that happen to be musicians, not important. But it has a structure, and the important point is to expose, let's say, a musical argument, a musical idea, and to develop it and to bring it to a close, a first paragraph. Four movements, four music dramas in the Ring. The first one, Das Rheingold, is like a parallel to that. It exposes the gods, it exposes how the Ring got stolen, it exposes why Wotan has only one eye and why his wife Fricka who is the goddess of home and hearth, is always worrying about keeping him home because he has a tendency to wander off down to earth and mate with mortal women. You know, Zeus was the same. Greek or Nordic, all the gods do that. And Fricka, his wife, wants to get him home. She encourages him. He builds a magnificent castle for himself, powerful and proud. It's called Valhalla. It's like Mount Olympus. And so he's hired the giants. There are giants, and they've built it for him. And it's finished, and they want to come and get paid. Of course, he doesn't want to pay them. And that's also the second sin of Adam, so to speak. Alberich stole the gold. He's immortal. Wotan is God, and he is the most powerful god. Of course, the Greeks had many gods, but he was the most powerful god, and he had a spear, and on this spear were the laws of society and of the world, and he was the protector of those laws. The only thing is that when he could not get around how he didn't want to pay the giants, they wanted to steal Freya. Freya is the goddess of youth. She was also the sister of Fricka. they didn't want to lose Freya because she had golden apples, and when she was taken away by the giants, they lost their youth. They all aged, you know, gods are ageless. They've been around forever, and they will last forever. So he was stuck. He had to contradict his own laws, and when an authority figure contradicts their own laws, so goes the myth, they too must fall. And this, of course, this long story will be about the fall of Votan as well, and the twilight of the gods, and that, of course, is the last opera. So the second opera is very similar to the lyric, romantic, sometimes romantic, but certainly the singing movement of a symphony, slower and singing. And so Vidi Valka is the opera that's all about love. And that's maybe one of the reasons it has, if there was one that was extracted and more popular than the other, it is Valkyrie. And that's not just because it's starring Plácido Domingo. You know, when everybody thinks of love, they think of Plácido. We all do. But it's two love stories. There is an erotic love story, and there is a so to speak, horizontal, and there is a vertical love story. The vertical love story is about Votan and his favorite daughter, Brunhilde, whom he is obliged to punish and to deprive of her godhead, and she is left on a mountain with a fire burning around her to sleep for as long as anybody doesn't come and wake her. Well, of course, if there's a fire around the mountain, only a great hero can come, and this is where it becomes a fairy tale. The handsome or the brave prince who gets through obstacles and he kisses the sleeping Budi and she awakes, and they are in love and they live happily ever after. So there is a story there. Valkyrie, though, is the story of this father-daughter relationship and the horizontal love of Siegmund and Sieglinde. A little shocking because they fall in love and consummate that love even though they discover that they are twins. You never saw that, did you? Yeah. Yeah, well, when you think about it, yes, taboo, yes, and definitely a taboo. However, the genius of Wagner is such that the power of the music, the power of their discovery of love with each other is so extraordinary that you cannot not sympathize with them. They get punished, don't worry. Everybody always does, and that, of course, is the old Greek adage, well, the basis of all of these stories, that some form of hubris or some form of some fatal flaw, usually defiance of the gods, brings about punishment, and the stories are many. And so they, because they defy the gods, not purposely, not to defy the gods, but in fact they do, they will of course be punished. If you're terribly shocked by the portrayal of incest in this incestuous love, don't be so shocked. You know that most mythologies have multiple, if not, well, at least one or two. There are incestuous relationships between gods in almost every mythology. That's how it got to be. And if you're still having trouble, figure out the Garden of Eden and tell me who the second woman was and who her parents were. I think you'll keep thinking about it until you figure it out. We don't... Somebody did something with a family member. There's no question. So you see, we all have it. This exists in all of it. So we have love story. That's our second movement. Our third movement now is like a scherzo. You know, symphonies, especially after Beethoven, had a fast third movement. It used to be a minuet or a courtly dance in the time of Bach. But as the courts of Europe started to disappear, the French Revolution, the growth of the bourgeoisie, it got this third movement abandons the court dances because nobody knows what they are anymore. And this develops this almost demonic fast dance. Well, that's the scherzo in this is Siegfried. Siegfried has an enormous amount of humor. People think of Wagner as not funny. Not true at all. Wagner had a wonderful sense of humor, and when he applies it, as he did in his one comedy, Die Meistersinger, he shows to be a master of that as well. Siegfried is the story of the young Siegfried, who, of course, is the hero born of that incestuous union, even though they've been punished, he grows up not knowing his parents, and this is a real fairy tale. There's a dragon, there's magic, there's a wicked dwarf in the woods, there's the young hero who plays with the animals and he only knows, he's never seen most. He knows that Mima the dwarf is in his father, why? Because he's looked into a pond and he sees his own face and he says, I look good and you look awful, how can you be my father? You see a real adolescent giving his surrogate father a hard time. He slays the dragon, he licks the dragon's blood, this gives him magic, the magic powers to understand the babblings of a bird. The bird leads him to Brunhilde. The bird tells him that Mima is planning to kill him, so he kills him first. He meets Wotan at the crossroads, so to speak, and he breaks Wotan's spear. Remember the spear that had the law in it? He didn't realize it, but of course he is reenacting Oedipus. He is breaking the spear of his grandfather because Siegmund and Sieglinde, the incestuous pair from Valkyrie, were the children of Wotan, and so therefore he is Wotan's grandson. Now, he breaks his spear as Oedipus slays King Laios at the crossroads, and he goes on not to marry his mother, but to find Brunhilde at the top of the rock. But she is his aunt, because she is, of course, the daughter of Wotan. So there we go again. You know, meets her up on there, and by the way, that means Wotan is not only his grandfather, he becomes his father-in-law. So Siegfried ends in a great, great jubilation. They will live happily ever after, except that this is a four-movement symphony and not a three-minute symphony. So you get to this big, enormous last work that is called Götterdämmerung. In German, that means twilight of the gods. That's the classic translation of this. A Dämmerung is either is the hazy light you see at dawn or at dusk. And of course, he's meaning this in the second sense. This is the dusk. This is the end of the gods. The era of the gods is coming to an end, and it's an apocalyptic work. It is, and in terms of the metaphor with the symphony, it is a large free form last movement. And apocalyptic literature, of course, every culture has apocalyptic literature. We have it, of course, in our civilization. Most religions have some form of discussion of apocalypse. It's the end of the world. Apocalypse originally didn't mean the end. It just meant a revelation. There's a big change, but we've come to take the word as an end. Now, it is a big change. The world is going to be changed at the end because it's going to be burned up. Okay, the Siegfried, the great hero, has died. He's been murdered, and Brunhilde, who of course loves him, brings him to a funeral pyre and gives him a funeral worthy of a hero. So she wants to burn that up, and in the process, she burns up the entire world. And then what happens? Valhalla burns up. The gods burn up. Everything's gone. The world is purified. And then the Rhine overflows its banks. The gold and the ring, which has been the big story, this source of power, Brunhilde throws this into the water back to the Rhine maidens, who take the ring, and the last wicked villain, Hagen, jumps in there trying to get that ring. They drag him down to the bottom of the Rhine River, and then you have an apocalyptic event. Simultaneously, the banks have overflowed, they go back, the world burns and is purified. And this is not a horrifying burning. This is a cleansing burning. And so at the end, we are cleansed and the world is set back into its harmony. And that harmony means the gold is back in the Rhine. The Rhine maidens, of course, exist probably forever in some way or other. And everything's fine. Everything's back where it should have been at the beginning. And so that is the cycle. Now, there's one interesting factor that I think is significant, although Wagner never indicates to us that Alberich, the dwarf who stole the ring in the first place, actually dies or is destroyed. He's not accounted for at the end of the ring. He does appear briefly in Götterdämmerung, but he appears in a dream to his illegitimate son, Hagen. who is also wicked, deeply wicked. And we're not quite sure if that's the real Alberich who's come to talk to his son while his son is snoring, or if this is actually Hagen's dream of his father. But of course, the obsession is get the ring, get the ring, get the ring. My own inclination is to think that Alberich, yes, is still alive, although you don't need to view it that way. But the fact that he remains with no account at the end, what happened to him, is interesting to me because it poses a question. If Alberich is alive, maybe, just maybe, he's going to go back to the Rhine and try to steal that ring again. And then guess what? Exactly. It starts all over again. So the question becomes now, this myth, is this myth about the passage from the world of the gods to the world of humans? Remember, this is the age of humanism. This is, you know, not very long after the age of enlightenment, the French Revolution, which was supposed to turn out wonderfully, that didn't turn out quite as wonderfully. But this is the age of humanism, and this is the age that we don't need the gods anymore. That we human beings have the potential and the dignity to actually construct our own world and to live in it in a dignified manner. So is Wagner saying, yes, the gods are done, and now as human beings? Because Brynhild and Siegfried were supposed to be the beginning of the new race, a race of heroes. Well, is he saying we don't need gods, and actually we don't need heroes, we just need human beings who behave in a dignified way as a hero might or as the gods might? And is this the beginning of a new era? So that if there had been a sequel to Gurd Damrung, and I mean he would have had to live another 20 years to have done that, if there were to be a sequel to The Ring, what would happen? Would it be a new world, and then would it be a new story? Or would it go back to the beginning and all start again because this is the history of human beings and our lives, that it goes in cycles? So the question that's really posed is this: is history cyclical or is it linear? In other words, if it's linear, yes, it's the end of an era and it will be some other era where there'll be another story. But if it's cyclical, it's going to happen all over again. Now, does human history, there are maybe three possibilities. It's linear, or it's cyclical, or it's both at the same time. In other words, there are cycles and cycles and cycles and cycles, but these cycles eventually make a line. Well, there is no answer to this question. I mean, I don't think there's an answer to this question, period, in life, but there's certainly not really an answer in Wagner. Now, when you experience his work, you will experience it as an end. It is complete. It is apocalyptic. It's Noah's flood. It is a baptism or a cleansing by fire and by water. There is the sense that there is a new life afterwards. But because that question remains on my mind, is Alberich and is he going to do it again, and is it going to all happen again, my feeling is that that is somehow, even unconsciously, part of the story of Wagner's Ring. Now, this shouldn't trouble you. I think it should fascinate all of us. And so here's my suggestion. After you've seen Goethe Dämmerung now, come back to the first cycle in June. And when you get to the end of the first cycle and you leave with that question, well, does it start all over again or not? Is it all? The answer is yes. We have a second cycle. So then you should come to the second cycle. And what's the great thing about the second cycle is, having seen it from the end, you will begin like rereading an Agatha Christie mystery. You will start to see, yes, this is how it started, and that led to X, which led to Y, which led to Z. You start to see the whole, and you start to see many more details. Now, when you get to the end of the second cycle, you're still not going to be sure, so that's a time to come to the third cycle. And when you get to the third cycle, you will see 10 times more than you did in the first cycle, because now you will have accumulated all of this from the second and the third cycle. And that's, by the way, how you become a ring freak. And so if you got three of them down this June, you're well on your way to catching up to that lovely gentleman who has 84 under his belt. And it's understandable. I've certainly not seen 84 rings, But I could do that, and I would love that life was long enough to conduct 84 rings, and I can't imagine I would ever get tired of it. I must tell you that every day we started re-rehearsing Rheingold this afternoon, just now that Goethe Dämmerung is up. Every day you go back, you hear things, you see connections that you didn't see before. And I have also to say that I am particularly proud of I say it's my orchestra. That's not really true. It's their, it's its own self. But I feel like I feel very proud, like a father and a brother to all of my musicians. I remember the first rehearsal, and they all looked up at me, of Rheingold, a little more than a year ago, looked up at just in terror. I mean, I think one person in the orchestra had actually played Das Rheingold. And when we got to Rheingold, there was one person that had, when we got to Valkyrie, one person had played Valkyrie, but it wasn't the same person. And they looked at me and I said, don't worry, I've done it. You're going to see. It all looks like climbing Mount Everest now. And when we're all done with Rheingold, you're ready to start Valkyrie. And that's going to look big. And as you go one by one, by the time we're finished with Goethe Dämmerung and we start again with Rheingold, which we're about to do, you're going to think that Rheingold is a piece of cake. And why is that? Because it is a mind-expanding experience. There is just no choice. To be able to put out that amount of intensity of such a difficult work to play, hours of concentration, your mind expands. And so everything else seems smaller afterwards, and you can see things in a perspective that you haven't necessarily been able to appreciate in that time. And I think this is also true for the general listening public. For those of you that have never seen a Ring opera, you can be just like my mother and walk in there. You don't have to know a thing. If you want to read about it, that's great. You know, you can go online. You can get on at the LA Opera website, and there's articles and stories. I write a lot of articles myself. They're in there. There's synopses. You can tell the story. You can go on. You can Google the Ring, the Nordic myths. You can get the whole family tree up there. Or Wotan, the head god, and Fricka, his wife. And then there's Wotan, who went to Mother Earth. Her name is Erda, and he mated with her, and he had lots of daughters, and they were called Valkyries, and his favorite one is Brunhilde. And then he went and mated with a mortal woman, and he created Siegmund and Sieglinde, and they mistakenly mated with each other, and they made Siegfried, and then Siegfried made Brunhilde, and then Alberich goes out and has a child by another mortal woman, and that's Hagen, and he's in there. And then there are Norns who are they spin fate the way the spinners in Greek mythology spin people's fates. They're also daughters of Wotan and Erda. There's a very complicated and fascinating family tree. And you can get all of that on Google. You can get the whole story before you start. But then in the end, it's all about the music that goes with it. And so you can, all of that is available out there before you come. And for those of you who know it all, of course, you don't need any introduction, so you just come. But the fact is, you don't need to know anything. And I think one of the greatest inhibiting factors to the general public now in our beautiful and wonderful country is that so many people have been to school and they had no exposure. Now, I'm old enough to have been back in those New York public schools where we had music appreciation, from the time we were 8 and we had tonettes stuck in our mouths. When we were 10, we had to play them whether we wanted to or not. But we had all of that. Now, unfortunately, in the last several decades, that's fallen out of the schools. So a lot of people just are afraid of classical music. They're unfamiliar with it. They see that big building. It looks like a fortress. Do I belong in there? Do I have to get dressed up and put on a black tie? You do not. Do I have to put on a tie at all? You do not. Do I have to act snobby like a lot of those people do? You do not. You see, this is the atmosphere that in the public mind is associated with the opera house and with classical music. Could not be farther than the truth. I believe absolutely, if babies were taken out like Siegfried and put in the woods, and they had a dwarf to bring them up and give them stew every night, and they never heard, but they did have a CD player, and they played nothing but Brahms and Beethoven and Bach A three-year-old would be whistling Brahms and Beethoven and Bach. There is no difference. You learn music by osmosis the same way you will learn your own language. So there is nothing about classical music that is not attainable or to be enjoyed by anybody. I don't believe in that it's only a select few. I'm certainly one of the lucky ones who got to do what I wanted with my life in classical music. But there is no elite. It's music for everybody, and Wagner would see it that way. Wagner, at the beginning of his life, wanted to revolutionize the world. He was, in fact, an equivalent of an early Marxist, and he got into trouble. In 1848, he participated in a rebellion in Dresden and barely escaped with his life and barely escaped with having been sent to jail. He wanted to revolutionize the world. He wanted to change the world, and he actually believed that his music could do that. And I'm not just talking about he was going to revolutionize it for musicians. He was going to revolutionize society. That was his ambition, because he believed that art can do that, and art can do that. Art absolutely plays an enormous role in forming a society. Now, he worked at that for a while, but by philosophy, he gradually moved from a sense, and I'm not a philosopher, but I think the man that influenced him heavily was Feuerbach. He wanted to change the world through art. Now, gradually, he discovered for himself the philosophy of Schopenhauer and the idea that the essential reality is elsewhere. It's in a spiritual form. It is not in a concrete form. And that more and more he started to live through this idea that the universe, the cosmos, the ground of being, call it what you want, the spiritual infinity was to be accessed through two things, essentially. And those two things were eros, the erotic love, and they were art. In other words, music, art, literature, poetry, singing. This was essentially a conduit to this greater spiritual dimension. Now, that was Wagner's view as time went on, and you get this almost a resignation about this world, and more living in his later works. Tristan and Isolde, of course, is the great erotic hymn. It is the access to infinity comes through erotic union. Parsifal, which is his very last opera, is more mystical, and the idea that both the mystic and the erotic have the door open to them, to this infinite space. There was a wonderful book I read many, many years ago on Tristan and Isolde called The Love in the Western World. It was written by a French Jesuit named Denis de Rougemont. It was written, I think, in 1939, and I read it back in the 70s. And his, of course, it was all about Tristan, and now he felt that Tristan was the essential myth of all literature in Europe from the time of the Middle Ages. And what he meant by that, it was our conception of love in literature and in art. And what is that conception? Well, two persons love each other, a man and a woman, presumably. And it's because it's not limited to heterosexual love. It is equally applicable to homosexual love, to any kind of love. That these two wish to be united, and there are obstacles. And the specific obstacle in Tristan and Isolde is the obstacle of Isolde's marriage to the king. In other words, there is it makes adultery necessary, and because it is attractive because of the unattainable. In other words, what we really want is the unattainable. That is to say, we really want this spiritual space up there. So the unattainable becomes attractive to us. Now, all stories about love are about the obstacles. The fairy tales are about the obstacles. You know, there's the hero prince, and there's the wicked witch, or the goblin who is not going to let him get to the sleeping princess. And all of those stories are interesting until the couple gets together. And when they get together, what's the end? They lived happily ever after. So, you see, that's the end of a nice story. Now, the end of a tragic story, of course, as Tristan is in at least in Wagner's dealing with it is it ends badly. And so it's a tragedy. So we have a tragedy or we have a fairy tale or even a comedy when the obstacles are gone. I mean, I remember somebody once wrote, it's inconceivable to think of Mr. and Mrs. Tristan in the kitchen in their pajamas and slippers. It's not interesting anymore. We want the passion. We want the obstacle. We want the suffering. We want the yearning. We want all of that. And Wagner gives it to us in spades. And so we get this idea that the erotic, Wagner believed it deeply, that the erotic will lead to the spiritual space. Denis de Rougemont wrote in that book, and I'll never forget this, I'm paraphrasing, of course, he says, show me an erotic person, or an erotist. I mean, I don't know if that word exists in English, but the person who is devoted to the erotic experience, and I will show you a latent mystic. I will show you a mystic in disguise. And he says, show me a mystic, and I will show you the erotic man, the erotic person in disguise. In other words, that these are two sides of the same coin, and Wagner saw both of them as conduits to that infinite space. Now, what does Wagner leave behind him is he's changed harmony. He has radicalized harmony. No composer after Wagner could deal with the harmonic system in the same way because he had stretched it to limits that had not been recognized before. This is one of the big challenges. Now, he impacted poetry. He impacted theater. You know that in the days before Wagner, they didn't darken the theater completely. But most people read the libretto. I mean, if they wanted to read. If you went to Paris, if you went to the Italian theaters, you've all seen, I'm sure, the classic horseshoe theater with the boxes all around. What were they? Those boxes were for the aristocrats, for the wealthy new bourgeoisie. They rented a box. Well, they owned a box. It was their box. And they came in and out of that box during the performance. They went out to dinner. The men went out to smoke their cigars. They came in to hear a special aria. In Paris, half of those people came to see each other, to look across. There was all the intrigue. You've seen all those movies, you know, somebody looking across the theater. That's what the opera was like in Paris and in Italy. Paris in particular, they were interested in the ballet, and the ballet had to take place in Act Three. And Wagner, to thumb his nose at the Parisians when he brought Tannhäuser, which is the only opera that was ever produced in Paris, he put the ballet at the beginning of Act One. And he did it to annoy them. He did it because he knew they were all going to come in Act Three, looking for the ballet, and I found out that the ballet had already come and gone. And of course, he did annoy them, and he never went back to Paris. But you see, that was the atmosphere. Well, Wagner blackened the house. You could not read a libretto. Now, what does this start? This starts opera for the initiated. Gradually. In other words, you couldn't come there and read the story while you were listening to the music. You had to know the story, or at least you had to pay attention very closely so that you would learn the story. So now, 150 years later, the notion has grown up of a listening audience that is already knowledgeable before they go. But you know, that does not have to be. You will end up much very, very, very knowledgeable, just like anything else. If you do it all the time, you're going to know a lot about it afterwards. But but Wagner started so many things, but specifically in music, he revolutionized harmony. He pushed the boundaries of drama way beyond anywhere that they had been. And he also, in a way, made emotions, and dramatic emotions and human emotions part of the measure of music. In other words, it was not just about the nuts and bolts. It was also about these extravagant emotions that one could feel. Now, opposed to Wagner was the school of Johannes Brahms. Brahms did not write operas. He did not write for the theater. He did write a good deal of songs. Lieder, it's called in German. Yes, the marriage of the word and song, okay, but it's all about the nuts and bolts. He was in those terms a conservative. He admired and adored Bach and Haydn and Mozart and Beethoven, and he was writing music that, in its way, although it produces emotions, was a very classical and compositionally mechanical, and I'm not using any of these in pejorative terms. I'm using them with full admiration. So what happens to the next generation in the early 20th century is that all the young German, well, composers in the German-speaking world, I'm talking Germany, Vienna, which of course was a very important center, they are all growing up with a challenge. There's been bitter polemics between the Wagner School and the Brahms School, and they are faced with having to find a synthesis of these two very powerful schools. And so the next generation, and I'm going to concentrate on that generation in a second, has to deal with this. And one of the reasons I bring it up now is because of Los Angeles Opera's program of Recovered Voices. You may be familiar with some of this. We have instituted this. We are the first major opera company to do so in the United States. Recovered Voices are the works of composers who were suppressed by the Nazi regime and who, for that reason, are less known today than they deservedly should be. This is the generation, the Recovered Voices, and I'm going to name names. You'll know Gustav Mahler. You'll know Richard Strauss. You'll know Arnold Schoenberg, also because he came here and lived in Hollywood after he escaped the Nazis. But the names of Alexander Zemlinsky, Franz Schreker, Victor Ullmann, Erwin Schulhoff will be less known to you. Now, right now, we are producing an opera called The Stigmatized, which is by Franz Schreker. Franz Schreker wrote 8 operas, 13 if you count minor theater works. He was the most successful composer of operas at the time, who rivaled Richard Strauss. He was identified by a prominent critic at the time as the successor to Richard Wagner and Richard Strauss. Okay, all the more amazing that after his music was banned by the Nazis after 1934, he went into complete oblivion and was not played, has not been played in this country until the present. We're performing an opera that basically was written about 100 years ago for the first time. I encourage you all to come to it because along with coming to Götterdämmerung and The Ring, you will see one of the many offspring of Richard Wagner in a form of the next generation. The challenge to those Recovered Voices composers was to take all the Wagnerian, all of the new ideas, the new territory that he had opened up to composers, and then to also take the nuts and bolts of the Brahmsian school and to put it all together. Franz Schreker, who wrote The Stigmatized that we're performing this week, Franz Schreker grew up and was blessed by the Brahms school. Brahms himself was aware of Schreker as a very, very young man. And yet, the magical world of Wagner and the music drama so fascinated him that he then produced in that vein. The Stigmatized, first and foremost, is a piece that takes the orchestra and makes it the protagonist, just like the orchestra is a protagonist in Wagner's Ring as well. It is not just a character. It has a protagonist because for Wagner, the voice of the music, the voice of the orchestra, is the conscious, the unconscious, the subconscious. It is the expression of the past, the present, and the future all in one. And there's a cliche, of course, that music starts where words stop. The inarticulate voice of the music of Richard Wagner surpasses any possible interpretation of the text. In other words, the myth is fascinating for all of the things that myth does to us. But in the end, in any work, any opera, any music drama, any song, it is essentially always the music that has the universal application. And that universal application is what we experience today. And so, as I bring this very thumbnail sketch of tiny, tiny little details and facts about this immense, 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 immense ring. I'd like you to bear that in mind. I did bring my little iPod here today, but I talked much, much too much. So if you want to hear it on the way out, I'll put it on for you. I do want to take your questions. So I know that you're free to ask any question you like. Often I give speeches and then people ask questions that have nothing to do with what I said, and that's fine. So we like you to ask questions, and if you avoid statements, but if you have to make a statement, at least put a question at the end of your statement. Okay.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC, 83.9 FM, KUSC, 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.